You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ka jistu mō toki ngua. Nau mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā, te rā te kaumātahi o hui tanguru. Kia ora and welcome to the Tuesday Wire for Ratu Tuesday the 11th of February. My name is Justin and I am your host today. My usual producer, Louis Laws, is away for now, but I am joined in studio with Danoon Ahmed. How are you today?
Oh, tēnā koutou katoa. I am ka pai today. Pleasure to be here on The Wire with my friend Justin, Flynn, for Louis.
How's your weekend so far?
Not too bad. I mean, the week's just begun, so who knows how the week's going to turn out, but
indeed,
nothing like Wire to wake you up.
Indeed. And coming up on the show today, I talked to Radio New Zealand Chief Executive Paul Thompson about the changes made to Concert FM. I also talked to Māori Council's Matthew Tukaki about Māori interest in public media, while International Desk looks at the general election in the Republic of Ireland.
And I'm going to speak with Andrea Black of the New Zealand Council of Trade Unions about the recently released labour statistics for the December quarter of 2019. I also speak with Dr. Rob Beaglehole about introducing a similar tax like the soft drinks levy found in the United Kingdom from into New Zealand.
Interesting stuff. As always, hei aha o whakaro. Get in touch with us with any thoughts you have. Tuka patuhi mai, you can do so by texting us on 5395 or why mai call us in studio 309-3879. E koa e waere ware e he ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene korero ano hei pakihire rokiroki maurunga I te paitukutuku o irirangi poho. Mahaere ki 95BFM airakati.com. And don't forget, you can catch all these stories in full and more by podcast on our website 95BFM.com. I tēnei wā tonu, let's go to talk about broadcasting.
Irirangi Poho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Radio New Zealand announced last week that it is planning to cut back its classical music station RNZ Concert and replace it on FM radio with music for a younger audience as part of a new multimedia music brand. Concert, starting on May 29th, will be taken off the FM band and instead played on the AM frequency and online. The move would also eliminate 17 jobs at RNZ Music, including all RNZ Concert presenter roles from late March. Patrick Hayes, a music and law student at Victoria University, told me he is frustrated about these changes, as this is the only way that musicians would have their performances performed, and RNZ Concert does so much for contemporary music and so much for diversity in the performance music sector. This is also echoed by Auckland University's head of music school, James Tibbles, who wrote in the newsroom yesterday that the function of concert runs much deeper than ratings and revenue, since it has a critical role and responsibility in disseminating live music made in New Zealand to the wider public, at home and abroad. So I talked to RNZ Chief Executive Paul Thompson to find out more about this new youth station's direction and his response to the concerns about this change. So this new youth-oriented station, what direction is it going to take?
Well, it will be aimed at 18 to 34-year-olds. It'll play an unrivaled amount of local New Zealand music, featuring all the best New Zealand artists and their songs. It will be commercial-free, and it will be quintessentially New Zealand, and it's there really to connect RNZ with a whole lot of new audiences, younger audiences, and to celebrate our culture.
But the current market, the radio market, is already quite crowded for, what do you say, as youth music, like NZ EMEA Media Works have got their own stations. How is this new youth station going to compete with the commercial markets and streaming platforms? Because I can now listen to New Zealand music on my devices whenever I can.
Yep, look, firstly, we're not going to compete with anyone because that would be pointless. As a public broadcaster, we're publicly funded. we need to provide a different choice and do a different thing. So what will make it different? It will be commercial free. It will play more New Zealand music than anyone else. And we'll also do things like recording and broadcasting live performance, which is quite difficult for others to do. So, I think that there is opportunity here. We know that young people are using every platform to access their content and music, including radio. We know that I think 75% of under 30-year-olds still listen to the radio, so you know there's an appetite there. But our brand will also be available online. It will be available on demand. It will be available through Spotify playlists. You'll be able to watch video. You'll be able to listen live. So we think that we can adapt to those preferences of where young people want to connect with us.
Recently, Radio New Zealand has also launched other youth initiatives, such as the Wireless, which folded only after 3 years. Why are you confident that this youth station is going to work?
The Wireless was primarily focused on news and current affairs. It did cover the music industry, but it was not a broadcast brand. So what we think is more powerful about this proposition is that it will have a broadcast element and an on-demand element and an online element. So this is quite different. And we think that the ability for us to play music with great presenters, this station's going to be staffed by young people who reflect the audience we want to reach. It will be quite different, and I think it will prove to be a more successful approach.
Now let's talk about Concert FM. Now Concert professionally records concerts by groups such as the New Zealand Symphonic Orchestra, APO, etc. And you're now moving Concert to the AM frequency and at the same time removing all presenter roles at Concert. How are you going to hold the same quality of Concert programming after the switchover, especially after that there will be no staff available to do so?
Look, it will have under the proposal, it will have a smaller staff. And that's because we do need to free resource to staff the new station aimed at young people. And whilst Concert's going to be available on AM, it is also available online and on demand. It's available through Sky TV and Freeview. And as you're possibly aware, Justin, the government is thinking about ways it can help us with this project, and it will be making some announcements this afternoon. So, I'm also waiting to see what they will say.
I personally know some students who also do classical music at the university, and for them, Concert FM is the only way that they will have their performances recorded and broadcasted. And there is moving to AM is going to have a lesser reach to audiences. And how are New Zealand's classical musicians going to showcase their work to a broad audience?
We are still going to record performance, which is a positive thing, and broadcast it. But look, the content will be attractive to people, and they will find it through our app. They can listen to AM if they want to, although they'll get much better quality to listen to it on a platform like iHeart or to watch it and listen to it on Freeview or Sky. So, look, there is a trade-off here, and it is very difficult for RNZ to do everything we do at the moment and do new things. So we're making these decisions because we really think it's important that we do that brand for younger people.
The Prime Minister herself told Morning Report this morning on Monday that she is quote-unquote frustrated, and she also says, quote, one does not need to come at the cost of the other. So could RNZ have found a solution to balance youth-oriented programming and Concert rather than axe Concert FM altogether?
Well, we're not axing Concert FM. We're not axing RNZ Concert. It still will continue. It just won't, under the plan, it won't be on the FM brand. But I guess her question is a fair one. We do want to do both, and we only have a limited amount of resources. And, I mean, it is also important to note that the government is looking at some ways it can help us, and I'm waiting to hear what those decisions will be, and that may be that provides a solution. And ultimately, we'll work with anyone and take on any ideas how we can make this plan work better and minimise its impact on people.
And the government has promised in the last election 3 years ago they will not reduce the quality of content and delivery to special services, including concerts. And might add to the question before, the Prime Minister also said this morning that the Broadcasting Minister has expressed concern at these changes. Why is Radio New Zealand management still going ahead with these changes?
Because we think it's the right thing to do, because we are responsible for making sure RNZ is relevant both now and in the future, and that does require some difficult choices. In saying that, we understand, we're listening to the feedback we're getting, and you know, we're keeping an open mind as we go through this process. I will point out, Justin, nothing has changed yet. We're working with staff on a proposal, and the concert service is continuing as it has in the past, and we have not yet launched the new brand. So maybe, you know, we'll just see what happens in the next few days to get clarity on that.
That was Radio New Zealand Chief Executive Paul Thompson talking to me yesterday afternoon about plan changes being made to Concert FM, which will move the classical music station to the AM frequency and become fully automated in order to start a new youth-oriented station. Just after I talked to Paul Thompson, Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern announced in her post-cabinet press conference an alternative plan for this proposed change.
I've made it very clear that I am determined that we are not going to lose RNZ Concert on FM. Cabinet today decided to look at what would be involved in ensuring that is the case. From here, our expectation is that a cabinet paper will be prepared, which lays out what would be involved in freeing up the 102 FM frequency. That spectrum has been shelved for the last 20 years for the purpose of providing youth-targeted programming, something that many in this arena will be familiar with since 1999. In the meantime, we believe Radio New Zealand has New Zealand On Air funding obligations to continue programming until June, and we intend to use the time available to work constructively to find a solution.
That was Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern. And I would like your thoughts on this current situation regarding Concert FM. So do text us on 5395 or call us 309-3879. Ko te waia, tēnei marunga BFM. We will be back after a break. You're listening to The Wire with Justin.
Remember the 80s?
Shit, yeah. Love the past.
Yeah, love the past. Some Spaceys, 1 cent lollies.
Dog shit went white. Good Star Wars on VHS.
Bit of fried chicken and a couple of beers.
I mean, the beers weren't that good.
That beers are pretty shit, yeah. But the rest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wednesday to Sunday for all of February, Electric Chicken are doing a pop-up at Save Ferris. Craft beer, pinball, video games, and now, Morningside's favourite fried free-range chicken. The 80s, but with tasty chicken and way better beer. Electric Chicken at Save Ferris, 224 Simon Street, Eden Terrace.
Auckland Transport is making improvements to Tāmaki Drive between Key Street and the Ngāpipi Bridge starting early February. We are extending the cycleway from Key Street up to the Ngāpipi Bridge and will also be raising the height of the road in some sections to protect against flooding. During the works, drivers may experience delays on Tāmaki Drive during peak travel periods, so you may want to change your route, or, if you can, travel outside peak hours. For more information, head to at.govt.nz.
It's music.
'95 BFM. The original originator.
We're an underground radio station here, and we bring the truth.
95 BFM, broadcast to the world and podcast to your device. Go to 95BFM.com for show podcasts.
The French, for instance, love the cock.
You're tuned into The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire, and we are now talking about broadcasting. As you may have known, last week the government also announced work will begin on a business case for creating a new supersized public broadcaster, merging Radio New Zealand and Television New Zealand. The new entity would receive a mixture of both government funding and advertising. But the New Zealand Māori Council said this merger is not in the best interest of Māori, and any broadcasting reforms to public media must also ensure the sustainability of Māori or iwi broadcasting. I talked to the council's executive director, Matthew Tukaki, about this, and I first asked him about the current state of Māori and iwi broadcasting.
Well, it's a complete and utter mess. I mean, if you have a look at the where we've come from in terms of the Te Reo Māori claim in 1985 that brought into being Māori as the national language of New Zealand, right through to the spectrum claims and the State Owned Enterprises Act that the Māori Council really went for gold on. We saw a brief rise of iwi Māori radio as a result of those claims to broadcast our messages across the airwaves. Back then it was pretty much just the AM band. And then all of a sudden we're in the world of digital media, online content, live streaming and all that sort of stuff. And yet the infrastructure is way back in the early 1990s. So there has been probably, we estimate, a good underinvestment by about $50 million in terms of equipment, technology, and that sort of stuff, and a further $15 million underinvestment in building human potential. And what I mean by human potential is our young Māori in particular, who want a career in broadcasting, but find little way in. And of course, there's limited numbers of places in Radio New Zealand and TVNZ. And so iwi Māori radio and broadcasting was always going to be a great breeding ground for young people to learn their trade, similar as a plumber or a gas sort of might do. And that whole opportunity has been lost. And now we're talking about a merger of TVNZ and RNZ. Well, we've already caught Television New Zealand trying to offshore and outsource the Māori content archive to Getty Images in the United States, and we put a stop to that last year. So how can we trust that a merger will benefit our people when the evidence tells us something altogether different?
I've got a friend who also is working in iwi radio right now, and what he told me, the infrastructure is really backdated. But apart from infrastructure, what about programming? Is there like enough funding from government like New Zealand On Air to make stories in Te Reo, or what about the airtime or major networks?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's not just about the infrastructure, absolutely right, it's about the programming as well. I mean, you know, in order to project a message, you've got to have the infrastructure to be able to do that. But then the second part comes to what is it we are projecting? And we've got to be conscious that that not all Māori speak Te Reo Māori, so we can't exclude them. So it's a combination of Te Reo Māori and content produced in English as well. And yet when we see the amount of money being spent on just about everything else, well, the government will always tell you there is a lift in investment in programming. The truth is a lot of non-Māori organisations end up getting it. And so we spread the talent too thinly. But, you know, when you have a look at the quality of news broadcasting and journalism in New Zealand, particularly in the Te Ao Māori world, if more money was spent on good quality investigative journalism, and I'll give you an example. The best piece of investigative journalism came from the Newsroom platform when they published the story on the uplift of the baby in the Hawke's Bay. And yet we know there are a massive number of stories out there just waiting to be told of the same vein, and yet only one ever gets told. And so if we were investing more in programming that wasn't just about documentary or filmmaking, but good quality investigative journalism, then I dare say that a lot of the problems that Māori are saying they face would come to light a lot sooner and a lot quicker. But that's a tragedy, you know, on the cusp of Taika Waititi winning an Oscar for his amazing, incredible work. Here we are having a conversation about how we can build more and develop up more Taika Waititis, you know, more Nancy Brunnings, more documentary filmmakers, more news readers, more journalists. But we seem to have stalled.
But why do you think that current newsrooms or broadcasters are less willing to broadcast news stories in about Te Ao Māori?
Well, it's not just about Te Reo Māori. It's very much about the age-old problem of what creates quality news and journalism. I mean, I myself am the chairman of News Now, which is a very large global news content distribution company. I'm also a former talkback radio host in Sydney on 2UE 2GB. which is our country's biggest network. And when you have a look at what is being produced, are we talking about real good news, or are we talking about lifestyle, magazine, entertainment-style news? Because let's face it, the quality of what is being produced in New Zealand is not that great. I mean, you've got some fantastic journalists out there, like Tove O'Brien, like all of these different people. But does that convert into what's shown on our screens or on the radio waves? And I would argue not. And the other thing, too, is news has become very opinionated. It's the job of newsrooms to report the news, not be the news, not make up the news, or not have opinions based on what is happening in terms of, national, local, or even global events. And that opinion is creeping in. I mean, we see that when it comes to Māori being unfairly targeted in some of these stories. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's face it. I mean, there are some talkback radio hosts and some hosts in general in broadcasting who probably should have stayed back in the 1950s with their world views.
Definitely. But how is a stronger and sustained Māori or iwi broadcasting going to benefit New Zealand as a whole?
Well, it gets our stories out there, and I'll give you an example. Let's talk about racism in New Zealand. Let's talk about what creates racism, which is generally a lack of understanding between two different or multiple cultures that creates angst, it creates anger, it creates a divide. What can help overcome that anger and that divide is the art of storytelling, of people better understanding the points of view and perspectives that people are coming from. Our history. I mean, New Zealand for a very long time has grown up with a single viewed history in our curriculum. And of course, that's about to change. But, people think, a lot of people used to think that Captain Cook discovered New Zealand for crying out loud. How can you discover a place when there's already people here? And so it's about bringing down walls and those divides that spring up and storytelling and iwi Māori broadcasting investment in that storytelling help play a significant role. I lament the fact that we have other now ethnic groups who have arrived in New Zealand to call New Zealand home, but they themselves also don't know enough about our history. And so by including them and becoming much more diverse as a nation, we also need to understand where we came from in order to better map out where we're going.
My final question for now is, you mentioned quite a lot about investing infrastructure for local stations, and right now the government is going to reform public media in the forms of Radio New Zealand and TVNZ. What aspects are you expecting them to change on?
Well, first of all, I'm expecting a lot more engagement with Māori. I'm looking for a lot more investment into the development of iwi Māori broadcasting because I do not trust that a merger of TVNZ or RNZ would increase the amount of content and programming being developed. And indeed, we might see the dissipation of it. But I'm also wanting to see, similar to the SBS network in Australia, the Special Broadcasting Service, it's called, that also develops up media opportunities for other ethnic groups, Chinese media and content, Indian content, media from the Sikh community, from the Pacific community, from all of these different diverse networks and communities. And we have Māori television, which is fantastic, but we also have to look more deeper, more broader, if we're going to develop up this rich multicultural society that a lot of people want. So for me, I have high expectations, but I'm easily disappointed by the government these days. Sometimes they just need a good kick in the backside. And I'd also warn the government that bringing in consultants like PwC there in Wellington who grace the towers of the waterfront, that quite frankly, I am sick and tired of being told which way to turn in my sleep because of an international consulting company. Now, if the government don't have the skills internally, then maybe they should have a look at acquiring those skills instead of always relying on some sort of big global consulting company to tell us what's good for us.
This is a sad, sad day. BFM, the font of liberalism and tolerance at the centre of the University of Auckland.
The Wire.
That was me talking to Matthew Tukaki, the Executive Director of the New Zealand Māori Council, about Māori interests in New Zealand's public media. We also had some texts and a call about the story regarding changes made to RNC concerts. One caller called in saying he's not over 65, but he's listening to concerts, and he says taking concert off FM, it's like taking history off schools. We also got two texts. One of them says 95 BFM is the youth station, while the other says on RNZ yesterday, one of the political commentators said we already have a youth radio station. It's BFM. Oh, thanks to that. What do you think, Danu?
Well, I think those are very interesting comments. I mean, I feel like Radio New Zealand should still have a youth sector. I feel like BFM has sort of solidified its own place in that regard, but still.
But what
about
concert, though?
Mean, obviously, I'm sad to see the concert go. I think it should stick around. Government cuts are never cool, so.
Well, because I did play classical music when I was back in school, and to see, I think there should be a balance in this. As the Prime Minister said yesterday, one should not live on the remains of the other.
For sure. Yeah. Classical music definitely has its place in modern day society. It's definitely not this fringe thing for old people. And yeah, getting rid of it is kind of weird.
Yeah, and not all, yeah, people younger than 65 still listen to classical music. Hey,
In fact, I was listening to classical music yesterday when I was cleaning my house of spiders.
There you go. Keep those texts coming in. You can text us on 5395, or if you want to speak to us directly, the number is 309-3879. And now, what have you got, Danu?
Well, on to my piece. On February the 5th, the government released labour market statistics for the December 2019 quarter. The statistics provide a picture of New Zealand's labour market, including unemployment and employment rates, demand for labour, and change in wages and salaries. There were numerous findings in the statistics, but most notably were that Kiwis are earning more, and female Kiwis specifically are earning at a rate higher than male Kiwis. I spoke with Andrea Black, the New Zealand Council of Trade Unions Policy Director and economist, about these findings, implications, and what they potentially outline for the future of New Zealand's labour sector, as well as certain trends I myself noticed in the analysis.
So the first major finding of the recently released labour statistics from the government was that the average Kiwi's wage has increased by 3.6%, which is about $40 per week. Do you think this increase is enough to match the increased cost of living Kiwis are experiencing in New Zealand?
Well, I think it depends on the type of person who's earning the money. So 3.6 is very much an average. So we'll have, there'll be people above and below. So, for example, chief executives, according to the Herald, got a 12% increase last year. And looking at the household labour cost price indexes, which talk about kind of the cost of living for different types of groups. So for a chief executive, for example, on a 12% increase, they had a cost of living of only 1%. So they're doing pretty well. If you look at people who would be less than that or possibly not getting that increase at all, their cost of living has gone up by 2.4%, mostly driven by high rents. So it really depends on the type of Kiwi or the person we're talking about. So the people at the top end are doing fine and the people at the bottom end, not so well.
So what you're saying is essentially that the data has been skewed a bit by Kiwis on the higher end of the income bracket in comparison to the Kiwis on the lower end of the income bracket, and that their increase is actually marketably lower than the average, and that is negatively overall affecting their wellness of living.
Well, I'm not saying it's skewed, it's just the nature of an average. An average has people above it and people below it. And so what I'm saying is 3.6, it looks pretty good compared to a CPI of 1.9. But when you unpack it, there'll be people who are doing really well and others still not as well as they could. So it really depends.
So when you take into all these variables, income brackets, and I'm also assuming that a Kiwi's location plays a factor, is an increase of 3.6% overall a positive increase, or is it just expected?
Oh, no, I think it's still positive, particularly, you know, if we just look at the averages for a minute with, you know, an average cost of living of 1.9 and an average increase of 3.6. So it says, on average, people are doing better.
And another interesting finding was that female Kiwis are earning 4.3% higher than previous years, which in comparison to 3.3% of men implies that our wage gap that is occurring in New Zealand between the genders is closing. Do you agree with that assumption?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's still a long way to go. I think our gender pay gap is around 11%, and it's still around 11%. It's just a, you know, smaller fraction. But yeah, look, it's all kind of directional, or what's the journey we're on, or what's the transition path. And I think the transition path or the process that we're going on is going in the right direction, but we've still got some way to go.
Critics of the wage gap often point out that the reason why we have one is because women tend to occupy roles that are on the lower spectrum of income. Do you think that this increase we're now seeing is a bit of a transition away from that, or is it actually women in similar roles as men beginning to earn more?
I think that's an awesome question, but I think it's too early to say, I'm afraid. Can I also just introduce the work that Isabel Sinn did a year or two ago?
By all means, sure.
The top labour economist in New Zealand, and this idea that women are earning less because they, you know, choose to earn less, she pretty much completely debunked and showed that on most kind of comparators, when you sort of adjusted for education, you know, you adjusted for all those types of factors, women were still earning less. I mean, the specialist doctors did work last year, and I'm kind of trying to think what the number was, but they showed a, even amongst specialist doctors, which is the kind of the top of the pile, there was still a significant gender gap.
So would you say, in your opinion, as an economist of the NZCTU, but also as a woman in the workforce, that the climate for women entering the workforce is approaching a more favourable stage?
I think so. I mean, I entered the workforce about 30 years ago, and I think a combination of, well, I mean, we were awesome young women at our time too, but the awesome young women that are coming through, I think, and that people are much more aware that there are structural imbalances, I think I'm very positive for the future.
What I found on my quick analysis of the employment statistics was that before the recession, which was around 2007 to 2008, the rate of unemployed men and women were actually about at parity. I think it was 3.3 for men and 3.4 for women. But now we actually find that at this year, the rate of women unemployed is about 0.5% higher than men. Doesn't that a bit contradict what you were saying, that the climate is more favourable? If it is, then why are we finding that less women are actually in the workforce?
Okay, look, that's a fair question. I think that what I was saying was kind of more general point for young women coming through. I think, I mean, that, you know, you're raising a very fair point. What I would say is that also the recent stats showed that the underutilisation rate, or the people who wanted more paid work but weren't getting it.
So, yes, you know, yes, it's about 10%, I believe, was it?
Yeah, no, that's right. What had happened is that had fallen by 11,000 people, and it had fallen by 12,000 women. So, again, I would say that all these things are point in time, but the direction is, it's going in the right direction.
So what do you think is perhaps the reason why we have a lot more women unemployed currently than men?
That's a really good question, and I'm not sure I've got a sensible answer for that.
I understand.
That was me talking to Andrea Black about labour markets and the gender pay gap. Super interesting topic. So if you find that interesting, whakapā mai, get in touch, text 5395 or call us on 309 3879.
Thanks, Danoon. And we just got another text on the RNZ concert story. Texter told us, I pay a monthly fee because I care about keeping BFM going, and I still have to put up with heaps of ads. Yet majority rich baby boomers get their station for free. While another just texted in, over 60, listened to Radio Bosom in its various forms since it started, still listening today. Interesting, it's taken Radio New Zealand 50 years to catch up with their quote-unquote aspirations, and it's not government cuts. It's a management decision taken by an appropriate of the previous government and its ideologies. Keep up the good work, cheers. Aw, thank you. But regarding on the majority rich baby boomers get their stations for free, what do you think, Danu?
I think that's a bit of a generalization. Classical music is appreciated by all. Just
as
like,
you just said, you listened to classical music while doing housework yesterday.
Yeah, and you said, Justin, that you play a bit of classical music yourself and you enjoy it, and you know plenty of people that enjoy it as well. So I feel like generalizations like that don't really add much to the argument. Maybe also paints our side quite poorly. So yeah.
Plus, radio news, in my opinion, there is a need for New Zealand youth-oriented music on public radio, but it's good if you can keep classical music on the side. Anyway, keep the texts and opinions flowing in. We would love to hear from you. But now on, let's go to Europe.
Today, we do not know what they want. They do not know themselves what they really want.
I've been wondering what that special place in hell looks like for those who promoted Brexit without even a sketch of a plan how to carry it.
Brexit means Brexit.
To Wire.
Sinn Féin, a left-wing Republican party in the Republic of Ireland, has declared victory in the general election over the weekend, breaking a duopoly that's almost a century old by two major centre-right parties, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. The results are still being counted right now, but Sinn Féin won 24.5% of the first preference votes in the election, almost doubling its share from the last one in 2016. The main opposition party, Fianna Fáil, slipped to 22.2%, while the governing party, Fine Gael, slid to only 20.9%. Sinn Féin's leader, Mary Lou MacDonald, described it as a ballot box quote-unquote revolution, and her preference was to form a government without either of the two formerly biggest parties, but that she will speak to the current Taoiseach, which is Prime Minister in Irish, and Fine Gael's leader, Leo Varadkar, and Fianna Fáil leader, Michael Martin. MacDonald also said if she did become the Taoiseach, she would start preparing for a border poll to test support for a united Ireland. And to understand all of this, I talked to former BFM news teamer Conor Nell, who is of Irish descent.
What are the three parties like, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and Sinn Féin?
So this election is looking to be a genuinely historic one for Ireland. Given the nation's journey over the last 100 years since independence, the country seems to be on the precipice of rejecting both of the post-revolutionary parties. But Ireland's weird. It doesn't have a distinct left-right division. Instead, the two parties are kind of centre-right. And that does require a tiny bit of a history lesson as to why that's the case. So the quickest way I can put it is Ireland had a civil war. Ireland had a war of independence between the old IRA, which is not to be confused with the provisional IRA of the 70s, and the British forces, the British government. 1921, there was an attempt to end the conflict, and the British, led by Winston Churchill and David Lloyd George, drew up the Anglo-Irish Treaty. Now, as is the case with many treaties that the British have drawn up, this led to quite a bit of controversy.
Well, we're very, very familiar about that.
Indeed, in New Zealand, very familiar with that. And basically, the treaty said that Ireland would be a self-governing dominion of the crown.
So it will be like Canada then.
So like Canada or New Zealand or Australia, 1921, which would mean that politicians would still be, there'd be a governor general, the king would still be the king of Ireland, and politicians would have to pledge allegiance to the crown upon taking office.
Did that mean Ireland will be ruled from Dublin?
That meant Ireland would be self-governing. So it'd be ruled from Dublin, but it would still be in the British Empire and still under the crown. So this split Sinn Féin, the old Sinn Féin, which is not to be confused with today's Sinn Féin. It split Sinn Féin into anti-treaty and pro-treaty, and Ireland had a civil war where brother turned on brother, neighbour turned on neighbour. After the war, there was peace, and anti-treaty became Fianna Fáil, and pro-treaty became Fine Gael. Now, that has meant generally Fianna Fáil has been more about rejecting Britain and going it alone and sort of carving their own path, whereas Fine Gael has been a bit more aligning with Britain, a bit more friendly towards Britain, and so that's where the division lay. We're now 100 years on from the Civil War, actually, this year, these divisions, young people today don't really care who their great-grandfather fought with in the Civil War. It's interesting, but it doesn't have the same kind of visceral feeling among voters that it did, say, 50 years ago. So what we've seen now is a split away from the two parties. So Fine Gael, which means men of the Gael in Irish, they currently rule. They elected the first gay Taoiseach and the first non-white Taoiseach. And I should explain, Taoiseach is the Irish word for Prime Minister. Yep. However, Leo Varadkar is very ideologically similar to John Key or David Cameron, right-wing, very Tory, oversaw a government that saw rent increases in Dublin, massively increasing rents, a housing shortfall, wage stagnation, a hike in student fees, massive increase in the cost of living, campaigning this year on a strong and stable campaign, a la the Conservative Party in the UK.
In
2017. They're doing exactly the same thing in 2019. Now, on the other side, you've got Fianna Fáil, whose leader is Micheál Martin. They ruled Ireland for most of the time since independence. They have an unfortunate reputation for corruption after they oversaw the massive crash in 2008, which hit Ireland bad. It was a massive housing crash. Troika had to be called in. The country was essentially audited under Fianna Fáil.
I remember it kind of like stirred a crisis in Brussels as well, because Ireland became one of the Euro pigs, Portugal, Ireland, and Greece. And yeah, let's say it first started the whole Eurosceptic sentiment that we see today, but that's for another time.
Absolutely. And Ireland was very much at the centre of that. In Fianna Fáil, there was a massive amount of corruption around the construction industry. A lot of people had fingers within that industry, so they were building houses that no one could neither afford nor really, which just no one could afford. So there was a massive housing crisis, a huge amount of corruption around that, and that hit Ireland badly. Coupled to that is their traditionally close relationship with the church and conservative Catholicism. In years gone by, that's really hit them badly recently, as Ireland has kind of secularized and obviously allowing
same-sex marriage,
allowing abortion in, fewer people attending church. That line hasn't really worked as it has in the past, and this year they're trying to put forward a more centrist platform, probably more right wing to Labour, you know, Tony Blair, probably more right wing than Tony Blair and that sort of thing. It's a very centre-right, centrist sort of policy. Maybe more liberal Democrat in that sense. Sinn Féin, Fianna Fáil. Fianna Fáil actually means soldiers of destiny in Irish. That's where, so they were the Republican Party back in the day, anti-treaty. Now, Sinn Féin, who are not to be confused with the old Sinn Féin, that means ourselves alone in Irish, and that they're the very Republican Party. They are the former PR wing of the Provisional IRA. They were led by Gerry Adams, whose voice was actually banned from being heard on the BBC and RTE back in the day. Listeners may remember that from the 80s and 90s. Their current leaders are unassociated from the Troubles. So Mary Lou McDonald was never in the IRA. Many of their TDs were never in the IRA. And TDs, by the way, is MPs in the Irish system. Chocta Dola is what it means. They've kind of built a new post-Troubles image among young voters, people who were born in the 90s, people who were born in the 80s, who barely remember or just don't remember the Troubles at all. Sinn Féin just don't have that same resonance with them. Older voters are still put off by their uneasy and kind of unrepentant attitude to certain atrocities in Northern Ireland from the conflicts, but they are running a centre-left platform and very nationalist. So United Ireland is at the top of the agenda. But they're also advocating building state housing, reducing tuition fees, rent controls, all stuff that's really drawing young voters towards them. And obviously there's other smaller parties in there. Particularly one of note is Solidarity People Before Profit, who are the Democratic Socialist Party. They're getting a lot of transferred votes from Sinn Féin voters. And so they are looking to actually double their vote in this election, I believe. So they're one to look out for in the future too as a potential coalition partner. Now, these parties are in a three-way tie at the moment. Mm-hmm. 22% the vote between them all.
Just before the election, they're Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. They say they won't work with Sinn Féin. So, especially for Fine Gael, why Leo Varadkar doesn't want to work with Sinn Féin?
Well, it's interesting you said that because, Leo Varadkar would never work with Sinn Féin because they are right-wing Tories. It would be like Labour and National going into coalition with each other. It just couldn't happen. So that's totally out of the question. Fianna Fáil, now, Micheál Martin's kind of flip-flopped on this. Like yesterday, as you said, he was saying never going to coalition. Now today, he actually said he'd be open to the possibility of doing that. I think Sinn Féin, it seems likely that Sinn Féin are going to try and get a broad left coalition through the Green Party, through Labour, through Solidarity People for Profit, and through the Social Democrat Party to try and form a broad left coalition to essentially keep Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael out of Parliament, which will just boost their popularity in the future to no end. But the thing is with the voting system is that it's done through single transferable vote. It's a proportional voting system. It's actually the same system that New Zealand uses for the local elections and arguably a much more democratic system because instead of the party choosing list MPs, it's done by second preference and third preference. So the people choose the list, not the party. So what you're going to have to see, we're going to have to wait and see is who transfers to who, you know, how that all kind of shakes out. And we're obviously in that really weird period where parties are deciding on who goes into coalition with whom. So, if Sinn Féin managed to pull that off, this is going to be historic. And this is going to be essentially Ireland breaking from that post-colonial situation they found themselves in with who hates the Brits more or who likes the Brits and towards a party that where that's becoming less of an issue. Obviously, Sinn Féin have made it very clear they're a nationalist party, but Irish voters are saying, OK, that's there, but also we care about this whole slew of issues that neither other party are talking about.
That was me talking to Conor Nell about the general election in the Republic of Ireland. That was only a part of a longer chat, which we also discussed the potential changes that a Sinn Féin government could bring to the relations between Dublin and London, as well as Ireland's position in the European Union. The full version of that will be available on our website, 95bfm.com/bcast, in the form of a podcast. But just one final text about RNZ concert. I listened to Concert 2 and grew up with it. Still, no denying majority concert listeners are more equipped to pay for their broadcasting than a millennial like me. Keep those texts coming. Ki te whakarongo koe, ki te wai marunga I rirangi poho. We will be back after these messages. You're on The Wire with Justin.
No! Escape that sentimental shit this Valentine's at Motat. Karaoke, silent discos, archery, love police, general shenanigans, no cliches, no expensive dinners. Motat anti-Valentine's, Friday, February 14th, 7 to 11pm. Tickets from motat.org.nz.
Life's too short for bad selectors, so improve your musical background with From the Crate. Every Thursday on BFM Breakfast, we'll treat you to a few pieces of delicious wax from Southbound Records. From the Crate, 9:15 every Thursday morning on BFM Breakfast with me, Troy. Thanks to Southbound Records, the largest range of new vinyl in New Zealand at 132 Simon Street and online.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire, and finally we are talking about sugary tax, Danoon.
The United Kingdom in 2018 introduced the soft drinks industry levy, which is a form of sugar tax, which places tax per 8 grams per litre of sugar extra found in a drink and also a base tax for all sugary drinks. The consumption of sugary drinks in the United Kingdom has decreased by 35% since 2015, which many attribute to the levy. The New Zealand Dental Association has been closely observing the effects of the levy, which they believe is strong evidence for New Zealand to introduce similar legislation. In this piece, I spoke with Dr. Rob Biegerhall, NZDA spokesperson, on potentially introducing a similar kind of levy into New Zealand and also the United Kingdom statistics.
So why does the New Zealand Dental Association believe New Zealand needs a sugar tax?
What we know is that a sugary drink tax is one of the most effective ways at reducing sugary drink consumption and thus the carnage that sugary drinks cause to all of us New Zealanders. in the form of tooth decay, obesity, and diabetes.
Well, people do agree that maybe we do have a bit of a sugary drink problem, but current market trends do show that sugary drink purchases, I believe, are going down and consumers are more inclined to buy healthier drinks. Why does the state need to be involved in this situation, and isn't it enough for the market to decide?
Well, what we need to do is look at overseas evidence. There was a great example in the UK who recently put a tax on sugary drinks, and there was a dramatic reduction in overall sugar rates. We heard that there was 30,000 tonnes of sugar were removed from consumption of sugary drinks. The issue about whether we need to do something about it is clear for those of us that work at the coalface, who work in the hospitals and dental practices around the country. We know that sugary drinks is actually the number one cause of tooth decay. We also know that even though that sugary drinks consumption is slightly decreasing, New Zealand still has the third highest sugary drink consumption rates in the OECD in the Western world. What the sugary drink companies are doing is slowly reducing the sugar via putting more emphasis on low sugar drinks, such as the Diet Cokes or Coke Zeros. These are just as acidic as, or almost as acidic as normal sugary drinks, fizzy drinks, and it's something that can definitely destroy your teeth.
So in what way does the New Zealand Dental Association believe is the best way to implement this legislation? Is it complete mimicry of the UK system where we have a set levy of around 14 to 18 cents on sugary drinks, or do you think there is another way?
Well, what we need to be done, we need to be guided by the experts and the evidence. The World Health Organization says we need to adopt a minimum of a 20% tax on all sugary drinks. The UK example is quite interesting because they have a two-tier system where the tax is increased over 5 grams and then again it steps up again over 8 grams of sugar per 100. So the two-tier system is an effective way of encouraging the industry to reduce the amount of sugar that they put in their drinks.
As you mentioned before, New Zealand does have a high obesity rate and also a high rate of cavities. Why just sugary drinks? How come we aren't implementing some sort of tax or legislation across all foods that are very high in their sugar content?
Well, that's a good question. The reason that Dental Association and other organisations are focusing on the drinks is that the number one source of sugar in our diet actually comes from the sugary drinks. So it's a thin edge of the wedge, it's the first step. And what we want to do is focus on the drinks and then move that out into sugary items, particularly junk food.
I noticed in your previous example, when I pointed out trends in the market and how soft drink companies have implemented alternatives that aren't high in sugar, but they have similar effects on your health. Are you saying by drinking things like Diet Coke, you're still at the risk of harming your oral health?
Definitely. Not only are you risking damaging your oral health due to the acidity, but there's new and emerging evidence coming out from the US and the UK to highlight that these drinks are also leading to weight gain and obesity and type 2 diabetes. These drinks are extremely sweet, and what they do is that they maintain a desire for sweetness for consumers who are drinking these products. The Dental Association is adamant that if we're going to be drinking anything, we should be drinking plain water rather than artificially sweetened beverages. Just like juices are also detrimental to teeth, obesity, diabetes. Often there's more sugar in juice, even if it's freshly squeezed and organic, than there is in a can of Coke.
I see. So as it's commonly called a soft drink tax, that isn't actually an accurate identifier. It would be applied to all drinks that are high in acidity and could be potentially damaging to your health. Is that correct with what the New Zealand Dental Association is proposing?
It depends which model and which overseas example we are going to be following. A number of countries overseas only target carbonated soft drinks. Others have also included all sugary drinks, which obviously includes juices and fruit drinks.
Some individuals are concerned about the cost for the state implementing this type of legislation and what we would get back in terms of tax revenue. What do you do to combat this opinion?
I think what we need to be cognizant is that these drinks are causing untold pain and suffering, but also costing the taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars every year
due to tooth decay, obesity, and type 2 diabetes. The drinks, once a tax, or actually which we're calling it a health levy, once a health levy is placed, we're hoping that the tax revenue is pumped back into health promotion activities and maybe even spent fixing up kids' teeth in the community oral health service across New Zealand.
Another concern people have is that highest consumers of unhealthy and sugary foods are actually New Zealanders in the lower class. Some people are concerned that policies like this are regressive and target New Zealanders of a lower income bracket and actually place a higher economic burden on them.
Well, what we also know is that tooth decay, obesity and type 2 diabetes is also regressive. The lower down the socioeconomic class you go, the more likely you are to drink sugary drinks, the more likely you are to have no teeth, the more likely you are to be obese and have type 2 diabetes. So this is the exact reason why sugary drinks are so effective, in particular for low-income New Zealanders.
Why is the New Zealand Dental Association just so adamant on a type of tax? Why is government education and facilities, and also perhaps lowering the cost in some ways of healthier drinks, enough?
Well, actually what the Dental Association is calling for is a multitude of policies, with this health levy just being one. We're also calling on the government to mandate water-only policy for schools, education campaigns to highlight to the population how much sugar is contained in these drinks. We're also calling on the government to make mandatory health star ratings and to ban sugary drink ads and sponsorship and marketing to youth in New Zealand. So it's just one tool in the toolbox. It just happens to be the hammer in the toolbox.
Indeed, it definitely seems to be a bit of a controversial hammer, for sure. And just one last question. Why do you think a more socialised approach to dental care that would, instead of taxing particular New Zealanders and assisting them to be readily more accessible with specific kinds of dental care, like tooth decay, not a better solution than tax?
Well, the Dental Association is calling on the government to significantly increase the amount of money that they spend on treating low-income adults right across the New Zealand. This is something the Dental Association is passionate about, and along with calling for a sugary drinks levy, we're also calling on more free dental services for low-income adults and also youth.
That was The Wire.
Kora te hotaka katoa mo tene wiki. That's all The Wire today, Tuesday the 11th of February. Thanks to my producer, Danun Ahmed, and special thanks to those who talked, called or texted to us today throughout the show. Apologies we can't get through all of them. And also, and ka koki mai mato a tera wiki. We will be back same time next week. I'm now leaving you in the safe hands of Jin for the next 3 hours. You're listening to BFM. Ka kite.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.